On Sunday, December 23rd at 11 p.m., Shug in My Bowl will feature pianist, composer, educator, and father of Creative Unity Collective's producer emeritus, Michael Mayburn, Harold Mayburn. That's Sunday, December 23rd at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. Listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. As the promo stated, oh, well, you're not listening to that, although I like it. We're not listening to it right now because we have a program to do. And what's coming up next is Harold Mayburn, starting off with a lovely tune called A Few Miles from Memphis. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, Shug in My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones. Thank you.
testing. Oh, it's, yeah. It's definitely on.
Yes. Is that how you're going to be, generally speaking? Is this your comfortable voice?
Yeah, this is my only voice. I wish I could change it. I really can't stand to hear myself. Really, oh boy, but hope I can get through it.
Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and this is Sugar in My Bowl, and I have a guest here. What's your name, sir?
Harold Mayburn, Jr.
Hi, Mr. Mayburn. Thank you so much for coming to WBAI.
My pleasure.
And you're coming back. Let's see. I don't know when you got back, but you were, the last time I tried to reach out to you, it was in November.
Right.
And you were on tour.
Yeah, we left October 26th, got back November 29th.
Right.
So just say I've been back about 2 weeks.
So who were you with and where did you go?
Eric Alexander, Vincent Herring, Yuris Dutley, Yuris Toupet. We went all over. We traveled about 26 countries in about 30 days, more or less. So we're France, Italy, Sweden, Denmark. It was a wonderful tour, you know.
Now, I may be jumping ahead quickly, but did you go as a sideman or did you go as a leader?
Well, I went as a so-called sideman with myself being featured, whatever, you know, which I have no problem with that. But it was a wonderful tour, you know.
Yeah.
But you get a lot of solo space, so it doesn't matter whether you're a sideman or leader, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
I had read somewhere that you didn't exactly want to be a leader. You just wanted to be the best sideman.
Right. I still feel that way, you know, because to be a sideman, especially if you play the piano, it's a great challenge there because you have to know how to accompany the other musicians. And that's the joy because comping is an art form in to itself, and a lot of piano players can't do it because they don't have the patience to do it. Mm. So I've always felt good being in the so-called subordinate role in the background and have people say, wow, who was that? Not an ego thing, but that's the joy in being an accompanist, you know.
Right. I've heard certain pianists comp and wonder, okay, what's he doing? How is that helping the soloist
right.
in any way?
Right. In other words, as the song says, you got to know when to hold, when to fold, because when you play with different musicians, horn players, you can't play the same way all the time. You can use the same chord voicings, but some you have to hold back a little bit and not crowd them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, give them room to breathe, musically speaking. That's the joy in comping, you know. And the best way to learn it is, I tell young students, is to play for singers, because when you play for singers, you have to use that same approach, because even with them, it's a different kind of mindset. Like some, like with Joe Williams, he likes a little Count Basie single line stuff behind him.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with Ella Fitzgerald, you have to kind of push her.
Hmm.
She likes that, like the big band kind of thing.
Wow.
So that's the thing that's the joy in being an accompanist, you know.
That we're cozy and clinging. All I can say is if I were a bell, I'd be ringing. I knew my morale would crack from the wonderful way that you look. Boy, if I were a duck, I'd quack. Or if I were a goose, I'd be cooked. Ask me how do I feel, little me with my quiet upbringing. All that I can say is if I were a gate, I'd be swinging. Or if I were a watch, I'd start popping my spring. Or if I were a bell, I'd go ding dong, ding dong, ding. Ask me how do I feel now that we're cozy and clinging. That if I were a bell, I'd just have to be ringing. From the moment we kiss tonight, that's just how I've gotta behave. If I were a lamp, I'd light. Or if I were a banner, I'd wave. Ask me how do I feel now that we're cozy and clinging. If I were a gate, I'd know to be swinging. Or if I were a season, I'd surely waiting.
I want to sort of backtrack to the beginning.
Right.
You were born in Memphis.
Memphis, Tennessee, right.
Yeah. How was music?
Music was a lot of music. It was a lot of rhythm and blues. And during that time, I hate to use the word hate, but we hated the blues because we wanted to play bebop.
Mm.
Now, fast forward some 50, 60 years later, I say, oh, thank you, dear Lord, for having me play the blues, because the blues is a rare kind of art form. Everybody can't play the blues,
right,
and you can't teach it. So long story short, it was a very good scene there. Unfortunately, it's more going on in Memphis then than now.
Hmm.
There are no jazz clubs there now.
Really?
Not one. It's a shame, too.
Wow.
Because you think about it, my high school, Manassas High School, the late, great Jimmy Lunsford started the music program at my high school, but this was back in the late 30s, early 40s. Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
And then later on, D.D. Bridgewater's father was our band director. When I say our band director, George Coleman, Frank Strozier, Booker Little, Charles Lloyd, Hank Crawford, Isaac Hayes, Louis Smith. He taught us.
Wow.
He was our band. So it's a great legacy from down there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But what we would do, we would play the blues, and we would tell the drummer to keep the shuffle beat. Then we would go into the standard songs, like All the Things You Are,
mm-hmm,
and Perdido. And as long as the people were dancing, the club owner was happy.
Huh.
That's how we got over.
Oh, okay. Know?
Yeah. But it was a good environment during that time.
So how did you wind up leaning toward the piano?
Well, here again, not to be redundant, you people say this. I didn't choose it. It chose me. I was hanging out one day with a young lady. It turned out to be one of my cousins. They had this old upright, and she went to the piano and started playing a song we call I Stuck My Dolly in the Mud. You know, it was like on all the black keys. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You probably heard it.
Uh-huh.
And the reason why I know that's the title, because I was playing at Smoke a couple of years ago, and this young lady came up and said, Mr. Mayburn, I like the way you played. And I started playing the first song I learned. She said, I know that song. It's called I Stuck My Dolly in the Dirt. We call it Mush, but somebody said it comes from something by Revell or Debussy. It's part of the movement there. So I went to the piano, and I heard this young lady playing, so I just went to the piano and played the same song.
Huh.
And after that, I wasn't really thinking about music. And then when I got in high school, I tried to play the trumpet, but I couldn't get a sound, so they switched me to drums.
Oh.
And then when I transferred to Manassas High School, which is where Frank Strozier and George Coleman were going, I played the baritone horn. And D.D. Bridgewater's father said, well, maybe you should learn something about the piano. And I learned a few chords, and then I just kept applying myself. And then when I went to Chicago, that's when I really got serious about it. You know, I met Spike Lee's daddy, who's a true, true musical genius who really turned my whole life around, musically speaking.
And that's the bassist, Bill Lee.
Bill Lee.
How did he do that?
Well, when I got to Chicago, I grew up with a great musical genius, Phineas Newborn Jr. Mm. He
Another
was my main mentor. I mean, there's so many great ones, you know, Calvin Newborn, Jameel Nassar, Gunnett Brown, great trombone player. Anyway, so when I got to Chicago, I heard Bill Lee playing these beautiful chords. I'd never heard anything like that. I said, wow, what is that? So I followed him around for 2 weeks before he would say anything. He wouldn't give me the time of the day. Then after he found out I was serious, he told me about a blind pianist who taught Herbie Hancock named Chris Anderson, a true musical genius. And one thing led to another. Then I was introduced to Ahmad Jamal, and then I just started playing myself because music was going on 24/7 in Chicago.
Wow.
I mean, we would work till 5 o'clock in the morning, you know,
and
we would hang out. I would practice during the day. I would go down to the Chicago Conservatory and practice on the piano, and they would play Chopin etudes. And during the day, they would say, shh, could you keep it down? So I found that after 6 o'clock, I could play the jazz stuff without disturbing anybody.
Right.
And I did that, you know, and I just practiced 8, 9, 10 hours a day for 5 years. Oh. Then we left and moved to New York City.
Now, were you enrolled in the conservatory?
No.
Okay.
See, I'm basically self-taught. I started when I was about 15 years old, but I learned how to read music and how to write music and stuff like that. But no, I never took piano lessons. I tell people that when most piano players, the ones you know about, were taking piano lessons, Chopin etudes, I was chopping and picking cotton. That's the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So here again, mine is a blessing from the Most High.
Sure.
He dropped it down, and I did the work.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you said we left and came to New York.
Right. When I say we, I'm talking about a group called the MJT Plus 3. See, in Chicago, and Bob Cranshaw mentioned it last week, there were three groups that had hit records, believe it or not. Ama Jamal's Trio, Ramsey Lewis Trio, and the MJT Plus 3. Because we were commercially acceptable to the people around. And we played good music. And our first record was called Walter Perkins, MJT Plus 3. We had a song called Sleepy. It sold 10,000 copies.
And you're listening to WBAI in New York. And as mentioned, this is Sleepy in the background. The player decided it wanted to pause. Thank goodness it started up again. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York. My name's Joyce Jones, and I'm having a wonderful conversation with Harold Mayburn on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
Copies in 1955 was a hit jazz record, you see. So we had work lined up, Bob Cranshaw, Frank Strozier, myself, Walter Perkins, Willie Thomas. So when we came to New York, we had at least about 2 months work. And we didn't just come here just trying to get ahead. We already had some stuff working for us. But the main thing was that you had to stay in New York 6 months before you could get a union card.
Oh.
And that was the main thing. So we were prepared to at least do that, you know. Mm-hmm.
So you're union now?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I tell my students, how can you not be in the union? As Ron Carter would say, look, man, this is business. You got to be in the union, pay the union dues. And the reason why I told a couple of guys, because say you playing somewhere, because every time you're on the bandstand, you never know who's there. You know, like up at Smoke, there was a gentleman, Gregory Generay, but I think his wife is, what's her name, Tamara Tooney?
The Law and Order.
Yeah, that's
the
wife.
Okay.
So see, when you play, you never know who's there. And I tell him, I said, the advantage of being in the union is because say, if some rich millionaire movie producers say, you know, I like the way you play. And have you ever written for films? I mean, this is not unusual. You say, no. Well, I want you to write for films and come to Hollywood. Now, when you go to Hollywood, you got to hire union musicians.
Right.
You see, so now you got to jump up and try to join a union. So it's a business, you know. So if you're a musician and you're a union, you know, it goes with the territory, you know.
Now, you inevitably wound up teaching.
Right.
How did that happen?
Well, here again, I didn't seek that out. It chose me. I was doing a concert with Louis Hayes back in 1980, almost 81. And this gentleman, Dr. Marvin Criven, rest his soul, he knew Frank Strozier. So we played the concert. So he asked Frank, he said, you think Mayburn would like to teach? Frank said, why don't you ask him? And I never consider myself a teacher. Even now, I'm not a teacher. I say I'm an advanced student because when you teach, you learn.
Right.
So he hired me, you know, and I started in 81. That's how I got there. And I've been there. It'll be 32 years in January.
And there is?
William Patterson University, a little school that was kind of unknown, that when you would talk about music schools and jazz, you say, where you going? He said, I'm going to Berkeley. I'm going to Manhattan, Juilliard. Said, where you going? William Patterson College. They would kind of laugh, snicker. They said, William Patterson College? They never heard of that. Well, they don't laugh now because most of the musicians out now, younger, are from William Patterson College.
Oh.
They're doing very well.
Uh-huh.
All of my ex-students are doing very well.
Yeah, Eric Alexander is one of your
students. He's the best student in the 32 years that I've been there, bar none. Joe Farnsworth, close second, but Eric Alexander is by far the best student, bar none, that's ever gone to that school.
And you play a lot with him.
He's been my lifeline for the last 20 years. We just recorded an album in Europe, and we got a beautiful date coming out where we're doing all ballads. It's coming out in February.
Now, he has a release. What is it? For Mabes?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's going back a few years. His latest one is Don't Follow the Crowd, which was written, coincidentally, by B.O. Lee.
Oh.
I introduced that song to him.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I mentioned the For Mabes recording because I was curious. When were you crowned Mabes?
Well, between Dr. Matthew Garrett, who was D.D. Bridgewater's father, we had another great band director. His name was Andrew Goodrich. He passed away. Some kind of way during that time, one day in the band room, he said, "Hey, Mabe." He was the one that started calling me that.
Oh, okay.
And it's kind of stuck, you know. Then some of my other close friends every now and then, like Julian Cannonball Adler, who got me my first gig in New York City that first night, and Milt Jackson, they called me Hands. Like Bob Cranshaw, we did a date, and on the first record, we got a song called Big Hands, written by Frank Stroger, for obvious reasons. You know, I mean, hey, what are you going to do? Big Hands, Little Hands, hey, what can I say, you know?
In the background, you are hearing Big Hands. This is Walter Perkins, MJT plus 3. And I had first heard about this when I had Bob Cranshaw on as a guest and realized I'm so glad I have an opportunity to come back to it, but I don't want to talk too much over it. This is from a Prestige release. Walter Perkins, MJT plus 3. Sleepy is the name of this cut, and it is the shorter version, I guess the radio cut. And before that, we heard... we heard How Insensitive from Kiss of Fire. That was... it had Mr. Alexander on tenor. And let's see, before that, we heard... Sleepy. Yeah, from the same MJT plus 3 release on Koch Jazz. Before that, we heard If I Were a Bell from Joe Williams from Round Midnight. Before that, we heard Harold Mayburn's A Few Miles from Memphis. Him as a leader, Harold Mayburn as a leader. And that was the title track on the Prestige label. And before that, we heard I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl, The Best of Nina Simone. The very best of Nina Simone, 1967-1972. Stay tuned for more Sugar in My Bowl and more MJT plus 3. As a matter of fact, we have Willie Thompson on trumpet, Frank Stroger on alto saxophone, Harold Mayburn on piano, Bob Cranshaw on bass, and Walter Perkins on drums. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, Sugar in My Bowl. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
But that's how that happened. Andrew Goodruth is the one that started calling me that in 1953, maybe, you know. And it kind of stuck, you know.
Well, tell me about the time. I'm going to go back because I don't hear enough about MJT Plus
right,
Three.
Right.
Tell me about that group.
There were three groups, and it was conceived by Walter Perkins, rest his soul, you know.
The drummer.
Yeah, the drummer. And the first group was with Muhal Richard Abrams, Walter Perkins, Bob Crenshaw, Paul Serrano, and a tenor player named Nicky Hill. Okay. And then that broke off. Then the next group was George Coleman and Booker Little.
Mm.
Then the next group was Frank Strozier, Bobby Bryant, / Willie Thomas, and myself.
Okay.
And the group that I was in, we were the ones that were very successful, commercially speaking.
Okay.
And the MJT plus three means Modern Jazz 2 plus 3. Two horns plus the rhythm section.
Oh, okay.
That's how that came about.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Walter Perkins, rest his soul, Baby Sweets.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what we call him.
Nice. I understand that you played with Miles.
Yeah.
You didn't record with him, right?
No, I didn't. Yeah. As a matter of fact, there's a new book out, and it talks about that. What happened, I played with Miles before Herbie Hancock. A lot of people don't know him.
Okay.
Well, Herbie's like one of my close. He's like my little dear non-biological brother.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened during that time, I wasn't thinking about playing. I wanted to play with Max Roach and Clifford Brown.
Mm-hmm.
But I was out working with Roy Haynes. So I came back home, and I said, well, let me get up and go get these 2 weeks at Berlin. Just, you know, mess around. He said, yeah, get out the car. So sure enough, when I got upstairs, my wife, Beatrice, rest her soul, she said, call Betty Carter. You got 2 weeks at Birdland. Strange coincidence. And she said, you know somebody named Prophet? There was this brother. His name was Richard Jennings. He was a great artist. He painted pictures of Bird. But he was close to Miles, and he reckoned, and Miles was getting a new band because he had played in Philadelphia, but he didn't show up.
Mm.
So the group he had, Sonny Stitt, J.J., Wynton Kelly, my hero, Jimmy Cobb, they said, well, that's enough of this now. Miles had 6 weeks' work in Los Angeles area, West Coast, so now he needed a new band.
Right.
Now, he knew about me because he, again, in Chicago, they knew about the MJT plus three.
Right.
They used to come see us rehearse. Long story short, I called Miles because Prophet and Joan Griffin, Johnny Griffin's ex-wife, they felt I would be good for Miles because, here again, of the way I could comp, and I could stay out of the way and be sensitive. So I called him. I said, hey, man. Yeah, what's happening? I said, yeah, what's going on? Yeah, what you doing? So I told him what I was doing. I said, I'm working in Berlin with Betty Carter. He said, I need somebody for the trip. So I said, okay. So he said, I'll be down. So he said, you know a good, some other instrument he called. I said, but no, I know a good alto player. He said, who? I said, Frank Schroeder. What's Frank doing? So I told Frank. Frank didn't want to join the band because he knew Miles could be a little tricky. You know what I mean? Like he might show up, he might not. Not about the money.
Right.
So long story short, he came down to Birdland to hear me with Betty Carter. And he never did shake hands. If he liked you or something, he was a boxer, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He would throw a punch at you, you know.
Oh, okay.
So he got the ticket, but he wanted me to open up, which would have been Betty Carter's last night of the job at Berlin. She said, no, if he wants you, he can wait. So what happened, they had Victor Feldman, a great pianist from Britain who played with Cannonball. He drove up from L.A. and played the first night at the Blackhawk in San Francisco.
Okay.
So we had a wonderful time, you know, but here again, you know, you always have to deal with the negatives. Rumors had spread that, oh, Miles is very unhappy with the band. No, he wasn't.
Right.
You know, that's with professional jealousy.
Right.
You know, and we got there. We did 6.5 weeks. He was on time every night.
Oh.
He said, let's play some music, you know. And he threatened to fire me the first night, though, because he said, I was playing a blues and F. If you know anything about music, anybody you know that can tell you about music, blues and F, you play F, A, C, E flat.
Mm-hmm.
You can't play E natural because that's not a dominant seven sound in blues. He wanted me to play E natural instead of, he said, take that E flat out or I'll fire you.
Oh.
No, he said, I'll strand you. Strand meaning I'll leave you out here so you can't get home. I said,
oh,
no, you won't because I got $1,150 in my pocket. And he started laughing. Then he told me, he said, you sure can swing, which is the biggest, that's another thing. If you can comp, you can play the blues, you can swing, because everybody can't do those three.
Right.
And you can't teach it. And coming behind Wynton Kelly, that was really a compliment.
Huh.
And we had a wonderful time. He always supported me after I left the band.
Yeah.
I did a record with Stanley Turrentine called Don't Mess With Mr. T. He said, you really got your stuff together now. But I always tell her, 7 Steps to Heaven, that day was conceived when I was in the band.
Oh.
And I was supposed to make it, but at last minute, it was going to be Vic Feldman playing vibes and me playing piano. At the last minute, he changed his mind. I said, what time is the date, Dave? I always call him Dave. He said, Vic's going to make it. Why don't you stick around? I said, no, man, I'm going back to New York City.
Oh, no.
But it didn't surprise me because I knew he could be, you know, but it was no big thing. But I had some great times with him with the 6 weeks I worked, you know.
Oh, okay.
And like I say, after that, he always supported. And there were certain things about what he was doing I didn't quite understand, like the modal, how to voice the chords, like on Milestone, you know. But after that, I told Margaret Miller, I said, you know, I really didn't understand it, but it's so simple now. He said, well, Mr. Mayburn, a lot of piano players didn't understand that kind of concept.
Right.
But now I look back and it seems simple now, you know.
Well, there are a lot of people who don't seem to understand Miles' music today.
He's a true innovator, visionary, musical genius.
Yeah.
And the reason why he's a musical genius with foresight because there are two musicians that he could see something in when even a lot of his peers couldn't. John William Coltrane, Ahmad Jamal.
Mm.
You know, he could see some special stuff in them when others couldn't, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I have nothing but good thoughts to say about him.
Thank you.
Now, you played with Wes Montgomery.
Wes Montgomery. That's it. If you download my name on YouTube, mm-hmm. you'll see us all over YouTube. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's
yeah.
another one that treated me wonderful.
Yeah. yeah. How was it working with him?
No problem at all. But it was a challenge because of the fact that nobody in the Montgomery family could read music.
Right.
So playing guitar, he played in a lot of those, what I call those hard keys, like E, mm-hmm. F sharp, B, because keys didn't matter to him. So it was right. a challenge. He said, hey, Mayburn, play this with me. So everything he played, mm-hmm. I had to be able to match it.
Uh-huh.
So it was quite a challenge. Like we got this one song called Jingles mm-hmm. in the key of E minor, and that was really something. But I was able to do it because wow. when you're working every night, your confidence is up, you
right.
know. So I played with Wes. He paid me very well. And if you made a so-called musical mistake, he wouldn't say, hey, man, you just look at your smile. Like, mm-hmm. if you didn't know you made a mistake, it's not for me to say.
Right.
You know. Nice. And we used to travel all over. I tell people now, we used to travel all over, four musicians in his fishtail Cadillac.
Oh.
Now, I don't know age-wise, if you're old enough to know about the fishtail, if not, ask. We in the fishtail Cadillac, we had the bass, uh-huh. the bass violin. I mean, the real bass.
Uh-huh.
Two in the front, two in the back, with the full set of drums in the trunk.
Wow.
Now, I'm not exaggerating. Full set of drums, suitcases.
Mm.
Don't ask me how it happened, but those cars were very big, you know.
Uh-huh.
And we traveled all over. We did what we call the Chitlin' Circuit.
Right.
Then when he made this record with the big band called Wendy, mm-hmm. he became in demand. Now, he didn't like to fly, so he had to go to the doctor and get some medication.
Oh.
And that's how we did the video. We flew to London, England. We played London, England. We played Italy. We played France. Switzerland, and we did Belgium, and that's how those two videos came about.
Wow.
So, yeah, I've been blessed. I guess you could say I've been with the Who's Who, and I played with all the singers at Birdland. Don't ask me how it happened. I think word kind of got around. See, when I came up, we came up in an environment that we respected our elders, the older musicians, the Papa Joe Jones, and the older musicians, like one of my main heroes, Mr. Hank Jones, Tommy Flanagan,
yeah.
they would scope you out. They wouldn't say anything, but they'd sit and watch and listen to you,
mm-hmm.
you know, because we were always on our best behavior. So I started playing at Birdland with Betty Carter, Irene Reed, Dakota Staten, mm-hmm. Arthur Price. As a matter of fact, I was telling Sue, I used to hire Herbie Hancock and Chick Corea.
Oh.
Because I was ubiquitous then.
Oh, okay.
I'd have a $25 gig. Now, in uh-huh. the 50s, $25 for one gig was a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd pay Herbie 18 and cover for him. I'd go down on a Saturday night and pay him his money, you know.
Nice.
But I was doing a lot of stuff then. So I feel I've been blessed. And that's how I got the new John Coltrane. Because at Birdland, it was three groups. So I would play with the singers. Then Coltrane would play. Then he would take an admission. Then he and I would have a lot of time to talk. I spent a lot of time talking to him, you know.
Nice. What did you talk about?
Oh, just life and mainly music. He was never satisfied. I mean, John Coltrane is probably one of the greatest human beings. And forget about music. We know he was a super-duper genius because he practiced all day. He'd go to sleep with the sax on his mouth.
Right.
True story.
Right.
But he was never satisfied, never egotistical. It was all about the music,
mm-hmm.
you know. He was really a joy to be around.
Wow.
So I've played with so many people, you know. And the thing is, most of the jobs I got was because they liked the way I comp.
Yeah.
And one of my pride and joys who really treated me great, I mean, that's Edward Lee Morgan. He treated me so good because Lee Morgan didn't believe in cliques. In other words, mm-hmm. his thing was, if you could play, it didn't matter where you came from.
Yeah.
You could play. I'll always be indebted to him, you know.
But when I heard the last session,
right,
and I realized you were on, I was like, and you were playing electric.
Yeah, yeah, I loved electric.
Really?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Actually, your voicemail has electric.
Oh, yeah, it's a little, I can't explain. I think
Casio?
It's about six, yeah, uh-huh. I think it's about 64 keys.
Uh-huh.
I let Micah have it for a while when he was in New York.
That would be Michael Mayburn of Creative Unity Collective.
Right.
This is his father.
I had a hard time getting it back. And do you know, that thing lasted for about, two or three or four years without having to change batteries.
Oh.
So when I decided, because, you know, I changed up, you know, every time you get a new phone, you say, what can I? So I put that on, and everybody seems to like it.
I like it.
Paul Stash called from a smoke. He said, hey, babe, that's a nice little thing, you know. Well, I'm going to play it, Smoke, starting December 24th for eight straight days.
Okay.
It's called a Coltrane Countdown. But I'm going to play again around my birthday, March 23rd, 24th. And I might record that little thing. You know, it's just
that
a little melody.
Great.
It's a little blues vamp.
Yeah.
But I like the electric piano, you know. Frank Strozier told me, one of my closest friends, you know, he called me, and I don't use this word, but he said, that's a nice little fucking tune you got there. So he said to me, I could see you over in Zimbabwe playing. Mm. I said, no, I could see you over in Zimbabwe playing it. He's being a little facetious, you know. But everybody seems to like it, you know.
Played with another guitarist, George Benson.
George Benson. I did one day with him called Body Talk. And Earl Clue, that was his first record day.
Okay.
And I got the call, believe it or not, from Pee Wee Ellis. Pee Wee Ellis is like one of the music directors for the James Brown horn section. See, that's what I'm saying. I never knew Pee Wee Ellis, but when you're on your best behavior as a human being and as a musician, people watch you and word will get around.
Yeah.
And that's how I got the call.
And that was a CTI record.
CTI record.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I was going to Smoke about a month ago, and who's coming out with George Benson? He's been sitting there. Hey, let's get a picture with Mabel. I said, okay. It was a good record day, too.
I sort of took a detour because we were talking about your playing electric on Lee Morgan's release.
Right.
That date like for you?
Oh, it was a wonderful date. You know, see, here's the thing about Lee Morgan. He was very confident. He was really a trumpet genius. Lee Morgan will go down in history as one of the greatest trumpet players of the past, definitely of the present and the future too, because there was nothing he couldn't do with the trumpet. When he was 14 years old, he was playing Brandenburg Concerto with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Wow.
Eugene Armander said, let this kid play any kind of music you put in from, he could sound great, letter perfect. And you didn't have to put in the accent marks. Now, you know how you bake a cake and you put the, you know, you can bake some kind of cakes, you don't need the icing.
Right.
Lee Morgan was like that. You just write the notes, he knew how to dress it up. So it was very great experience for me because he was kind of like a dictator, musically speaking. Not in a bad way. In other words, he would say, when we were doing a song I wrote on that day called In What Direction Are You Headed? Which on some airlines, they'd use that on airlines.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I don't get a lot of money for it, but somebody probably chose it because of the title, In What Direction Fly, you know.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Lee would say, he said, Grayson, my girl, he said, you take two courses on this. And he said, Hopper, Bill Hopper, Sansa, he said, Hal, you got to play something because it's your tune. I said, no, Lee, I don't have to play that. Case closed. That's what I mean by dictate. Once he said, this is what you're going to do, you're going to do it. He was very generous to me because he helped me build up my publishing company because he played everybody else's music. We only played four Lee Morgan songs, Sidewinder, Sierra, Speedball, and one other. So guys said, let's do this song by Lee Morgan. I said, I don't know it. They said, why you don't know it? You played with him all the time. Because he wasn't selfish. He let other people grow. So a lot of songs I didn't know because we never played them, you see. So every day I think about him, you know, he was really something.
Now I heard, I don't know whether, you know, you stop me if you want and I'll get rid of it if you want to.
I know what you're going to say. Go ahead.
You were in the club?
Unfortunately,
Lee Morgan
Unfortunately, right. And it was a funny night without getting into a lot of details. But you read about this album, a lot of people say, oh, he was on the band. Wrong. We were not on the bandstand. We were at the bar. You know, you probably see that on Music Choice. So, people, please get your facts right. If you want to know, call me. I'll tell you what you need to know without going too further, because anything else is for the move. If you're going to do the move and you want to know what happened, then we can talk otherwise. But no, it was a weird night because I had done a TV show with the late, great Lucky Thompson. Channel 13, Soul, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
And you know who I'm talking about?
Ellis Haslett.
Ellis and, Stan Lathan.
Oh, yeah,
they
were
the directors. So it was a nice band. Gunnett Brown, Percy Bryce, myself. So we did the show, and Ruby Dee and Ozzie Davis, they were doing some stuff from a great port, a black port from Maine, Marsh or something from California. So when I left the studio, all of a sudden it started snowing. I didn't think, I'm on my way to Slugs. And as I got, the snow got high. And, oh, boy. So by the time I got to Slugs, man, the snow was really up there. Now, Lee was just coming from a record day with Charles Early. So he came, and we played a beautiful first set, you know. And the place was kind of empty because it was very cold and the snow was so high. And he was just getting off of his, transition from the drugs to methadone. He was getting off of that. So you know how it is when three people get involved emotionally, somebody's going to lose out, not necessarily in violence. You know, nobody ever expected that. And he was at the bar with his former wife, in-law, coming-along wife, whatever, another young lady. One thing led to another. And I don't know what happened because I was sitting at the bar with my back turned. I moved to the front. And all of a sudden, Freddie Waite said to me, he said, why does stuff like that happen? You know, one minute everything seemed okay. And I said, that's why when I pointed and we heard pow, shot. And then we knew what it was, you know. And she was very remorseful for what it's worth. You know, she wasn't supposed to be there, but what happened, she was going to the Vanguard to hit Freddie Hubbard.
Oh.
But because of where she was, you couldn't get a cab.
Oh.
Now, if you're on the Lower East Side, it might take you an hour to walk there. She couldn't, so she was stuck there with nothing to do.
Oh.
And because of the fact that it took so long for the ambulance to come, naturally he couldn't survive.
Right.
You know, but that was rough. My system was messed up for two or three months, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because we here again, we were just getting ready to work, go to Europe. He was happy about that, you know. But aside from that, he left something for us, musically speaking.
Yeah.
He was a true genius, you know.
Hi, this is Bobby Humphrey. You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
But speaking of the electric piano, for what it's worth, I think, I'm pretty sure, I was the second jazz musician to make a date on electric piano.
Oh.
Now, Joe Zawinul, I'll give or take 65, he may have been the first one with Mercy, Mercy, Mercy.
Right.
But I was definitely the second one. Don't mean nothing.
Yeah.
But it was such an event, late, great Ray Bryant, who was one of my biggest, he came to the date to see us play at Rudy. It was a little wordlitzer.
Oh, okay. And Rudy Van Gelder.
And Rudy Van Gelder. Yeah. We did a date with Buddy Terry called Electric Soul with Ron Carter, Jimmy Orns, myself, and Buddy Terry. We did a song by the late, great Harry Whitaker called Everything's Everything.
Mm.
And I did it on electric piano.
Oh, okay.
So that's my claim to fame. I made the second jazz date on electric piano.
Nice.
You know.
Excellent.
But I've always loved it because it's a different sound, but it's a you have to use a different kind of touch.
Right.
Yeah. What I don't have a problem with, but Chick Corea plays very well.
Right.
Not Mr. Herbie Hancock.
Right.
And one of my biggest heroes, Mr. Ahmad Jamal. People don't realize Ahmad Jamal recorded Very Superstitious 25 or 30 years ago on a Fender Rhodes. On 20th Century Fox.
Okay.
And it didn't stop him. See, it's all a state of mind. Here again, I'm not a jazz purist. In other words, whatever I play, I want it to be pure. But there's all kinds of music. You know, like when I listen to James Jamison playing electric bass with Motown, you know, as Duke Ellington said, it's only two kinds, either good or bad. And if it's bad or tasteless, it's going to go right in one ear and right out the other.
Right.
You see, so I don't have a problem with the electric piano.
Right.
Chops and roses and Christmas on kittens, bright copper kettles and warm woolen mittens, brown paper packages tied up with string. These are a few of my favorite things. Reese, cream-colored ponies, and crisp apple strudel. The velvet sleigh bells and sugarfoot noodle. Walkies that fly with the moon on their wings. Have a few of my favorite things. Girls in white dresses and new satin sashes. Snowflakes that stay on my nose and eyelashes. Since the white winter that melt into spring, these have a few of my favorite things. When the dog bites, when the bee stings, when I'm feeling sad, I simply remember my favorite things, and then I don't feel so bad. When the dog bites, when the bee stings, when I'm feeling sad, I simply remember my favorite things, and
now, you had mentioned earlier that you had worked with Betty Carter.
Right.
As a matter of fact, you recorded Inside Betty Carter.
That's the best record that she's ever made. It's on YouTube,
yeah.
My Favorite Things.
Yes.
Bob Cranshaw, Roy McCurdy, and I rehearsed 7 hours a day for that day.
Wow.
Yeah.
What was it like working with Betty Carter?
It was challenging. She was demanding because she didn't play piano like a piano player, but she knew what she wanted,
mm-hmm.
and you couldn't jive her. So here again, the ability to be able to accompany her was a joy, you know.
Yeah.
But she was very strict now because she knew what she wanted.
Right.
But we had a good relationship.
Excellent.
Because it was all about the music.
And that's what has been said about her. It's basically been all about the music, no matter how people perceived her
and
interacted. It was all about the
music.
It's
about the music, yeah.
Now, it's written that you were one of the best bop pianists, you know, in the business.
Right.
I've heard said that at the time also.
Barry Harris?
Barry Harris.
Right.
Barry Harris was another excellent bop pianist.
Right.
What does that mean for you?
Well, see, let me clear this up so folks understand. That's a compliment, but I don't consider myself a bop player. This is what I consider myself. I'm a rhythm and blues piano player that understands the philosophy of jazz or bop.
Okay.
See, that's different. I'm more blues orientated.
Okay.
Because I grew up in the environment. Barry Harris is pure bop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's no put down. Gene Harris, who I have tremendous respect for, he said, I'm a blues piano player with chops.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning I'm a blues, basically blues piano player, and I have technique.
Right.
And in my concept, there are only a few piano players that play the way I do when it comes to blues. Monte Alexander, what we call romp and stomp.
Uh-huh.
Monte Alexander, Michael LaDon, Oscar Peterson,
Gene
Harris, Mulgrew Miller. That's so I really don't consider, because my hero is two basic schools of music. Most piano players don't even know this. Bud Powell, that's the bebop.
Mm-hmm.
But the other school that influenced me is Nat King Cole, who influenced Oscar Peterson, me, Joy Shearing, McCoy Tyner, Herbie Hancock. Years ago, Herbie and Natalie Cole did the Grammys, and they hosted. And Herbie said to Natalie, you know, Natalie, your father influenced piano players that play like him that they don't even know they do.
Mm.
So I come through the Nat King Cole school of music, which is swing,
right.
touch,
right.
see, and technique. Nat Cole had technique like Art Tatum.
Mm-hmm.
Because growing up in Chicago, he went to the same high school my wife went to, out of Wendell Phillips.
Oh, okay.
Milt Hinton, when Ruth Jones is down in Washington. That's
oh,
a real name.
Okay, thank
Lyle
you.
Lyon Hampton, Betty Carter's name is Lily Mae. Lyon right. Hampton was the one that changed their name.
Oh,
so I played
right.
through the Nat King Cole, so I'm not what you call a pure bebop player, even though I respect it and I love it, but I'm a blues piano player that understands the philosophy of bebop, of swing, of modal, whatever,
mm-hmm.
you see. So the people that are pure bebop piano players, Barry Harris, Sonny Clark,
mm-hmm.
El Mojo, Duke Jordan,
mm-hmm.
Walter Bishop Jr., Walter Davis Jr., you see.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the two different schools.
Okay, okay.
So I don't know if that clears it up.
Yes, it does.
But if you say I'm a hard bop piano, that's no insult.
Right.
But I'm really more bluesy.
Okay.
You know.
But either way, you're swinging.
Well, that's the main thing. That's now you just said it, George. If you Duke Ellison say it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. And you
right.
can't teach swing. You can't teach the blues, because if I could have been around Gene Harris for a while. I really could have played the blues. Yeah. And I do pretty good. Monte Alexander. Now, Monte Alexander can't read a note of music, but you would never. He plays the piano like he's been to every conservatory.
Yeah.
Ahmad Jamal's main influence, Mr. Errol Garner.
Right, right.
Couldn't read the music. So it's, these are what you call God-given talents. But once the Most High gives you the ability and sprinkle you, then you have to do the work.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, I've been delinquent. Sorry, peoples. What you're listening to right now is Mr. Stitt. I suspect this is to Mr. Sonny Stitt. This is from Straight Street on Columbia Records. It's a Harold Mayburn recording. As a leader, before that we heard My Favorite Things from Betty Carter, from Inside Betty Carter on the Capitol label. Have Bob Cranshaw on that one as well. And a former Sugar My Bowl guest. And before that we heard, come on, spit it out, you know what it is. Lee Morgan, In What Direction Are You Headed? This was a Harold Mayburn composition recorded by, that was such a great ensemble. It was like Jimmy Merritt. Come on, you know the name. Billy Harper. There were two basses. Reggie Workman. Yeah, I don't have the thing in front of me because I'm trying to be quick and not talk over this song. But, you got to get it if you don't have the last session on the Blue Note label by Lee Morgan. And before that, we heard George Benson, a little bit of Plum from Body Talk on the CTI label. Before that, we heard Harold Mayburn's voice mail message. Yeah, it's cool. I'm looking forward to when it becomes a full-blown song. And as mentioned, Harold Mayburn will be at Smoke on the 24th of this month. I'll mention it again at the end of the show if I remind myself. I will. Before that, we heard Wes Montgomery, 4-on-6 Live Paris. That's what the track is called. It's from Round Midnight. And before that, we heard MJ... T+3, Big Hands. More of Harold Mayburn on Sugar My Bowl. Harold Mayburn, father of Michael Mayburn, who was on Creative Unity Collective this Friday. See, I kept hearing this phrase, producer emeritus, and then to hear him on Friday, I'm like, he's not an emeritus. Anyway, stay tuned for more Sugar My Bowl right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. You've mentioned several times during this exchange how you can't teach that.
No, you can't.
I mean, depending on what we're talking about, right. You say you can't teach that. You know, no. You can't teach the blues, you can't teach that.
For example, prime example. Okay, we know this music started in African-American, it comes up through slavery, like mm-hmm. Lou Dunn said, yeah, this is slavery music.
Right.
But all nationalities can play it.
Right.
There are some that play it better than the so-called innovators, you know.
Right.
But, for example, Eric Alexander, mm-hmm. Caucasian, so-called mm-hmm. white man, whatever you want to say,
mm-hmm.
he can play the blues.
Right.
So you see, now how did he learn it? By environment, playing with Charles Erlin.
Oh, okay.
Charles Erlin played nothing but the blues, swung and played the blues, because Eric used to complain to his dad. He said, yeah, Dad, I'm out here with Charles Erlin. I'm not making a lot of money. His dad said, wise up, stop being a bozo. Hell, you're learning how to play the blues, aren't you? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So Peter Bernstein, Jewish, he can play the blues on the guitar.
Okay.
Michael Adon, Italian. Can, mm-hmm. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So, but I mean, you can't, I don't think you can teach. You can write down some notes, but right. You can play the notes, but it's still not the same because if the feeling is not there,
mm-hmm.
that's why I say you can't teach it.
Right.
It's by osmosis of being in that particular environment.
Yeah.
Like if I wanted to learn how to be a great three-point shooter, I just have to do like Michael Jordan and Larry Bird did. Practice, practice, practice. But that's a different thing because right. you're not really dealing from an emotional standpoint. That's
right.
more physical.
Very technical.
But yeah, very yeah. technical. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But that's it. You know, you really can't teach it. But if you're around it
mm-hmm.
and you have a little basic innate feeling for it, mm-hmm. it'll come through.
So, and the reason why I ask that, because you do teach at William Patterson.
Right.
And there are things that you do teach.
Right.
What happens when you encounter someone who is interested in the blues? And
well, what I do is like when students ask me about comping, I say it's hard to tell you how to do it. You just have to come and hear me play and listen to what I play, the way I do it, and record it and say, play it back. Now, what'd you do there? And then I can say, this is what I have in mind. But I mm-hmm. tell them, as an accompanist, you have to think big band, like Count Basie,
mm-hmm.
you know, because there comes a time when you have to boost up the solo. See, in rhythm section, the piano player is never going to get in the brown of points. If things are sounding great, they say, wow, the drama sounds great. But if one thing goes wrong, they're going to look right at the piano player.
Wow.
You see?
Yeah.
So here again, you're in the background, but you're playing a supportive role, so to speak, you know. Mm-hmm. So here again, I can't teach it. I try to demonstrate.
Right.
And then if a person has a feel for it, then it'll come through, you know. January 1 will be 32 straight years. And some of my students, like I said, I'm so proud of them. Eric Alexander. Carl Allen is the head of Juilliard.
Yeah.
William Patterson College.
Okay.
Peter Bernstein, Freddie Hendricks, Joe
wow.
Farnsworth. One of my students, a young man, lost his life in a plane crash. He was really talented. His name was Coleman Mellett. He was going to Buffalo, Rochester, to do a date with Chuck Mangione
mm-hmm.
about 2 or 3 years ago.
Okay.
And he would come to class dressed up.
Mm. Wow.
He could play. And it's good because, you know, you got some of the students now. As a matter of fact, next time we do a dialogue at the school, I'm going to have to speak on the dress code. I'm mm-hmm. sorry, because jazz is high level. Duke Ellen didn't look like no bum. You can't
no.
come looking all sloppy, as Art Blakey said. They see you before they hear you.
That's
and
right.
that's true.
That's
before
right.
you hit a note, people are watching you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's one thing I give the Marcel, especially Winton, a lot of credit. For other things, like his dress code is
mm-hmm.
is perfect, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to put on a Botany 500 suit and tie, but at least look presentable. Don't look like you just got off a garbage truck or something.
Right.
That's what I'm saying.
Right.
No offense to the sanitation people
sure.
because they're doing their job, you see.
Right.
But I've been there, like I said, 32 years, and I've had some great students
mm-hmm.
come out. They're working all over the world now.
Nice.
Some of them making more money than me. Bless their heart. Maybe I can get along.
So you have this latest release.
Right.
The tribute to Sammy Davis Jr.
Right. It's called Mr. Lucky, High Note Records.
Yes, Mr. Lucky, a tribute to
Sammy Davis Jr. Right.
Yeah. How did it come about?
I knew that's what you
yes.
wanted to know. I'm glad you asked. How, why? Because most people, as Gunnett Brown would say, J.J. would say, why not?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I tell you, it came about two reasons. Years ago, I was involved with the group, and the gentleman that wrote the liner notes, he kind of misinterpreted what I said, but that's okay. He gave the credit to Stanley Cowell, which is another one of my heroes, mm-hmm. a great musical genius pianist. Anyway, I was doing this group called 100 Gold Fingers of Jazz that was conceived when I was over there in 1989 with Joe Newman.
Okay.
And the first night, I want to fast forward. The promoter, the first night the promoter I played, the promoter was kind of a little standoffish. No problem. Because as Gunnett Brown used to say, no matter what you do, you're not going to be all things to all people. Mm-hmm. As long as you're okay with the Most High, then I sleep good at night. Mm-hmm. If you please the Most High and I can't please other people, that's their problem, not mine.
Correct.
So we went after, you know, because in Japan, they got a lot of clubs you go and play. So we went to jam session. I played my favorite things.
Uh-huh.
And Mama-san, see, in Japan, they pay you to sit in. You ever heard anything like that? I'm serious.
Nice.
You
nice.
Sit in, and you get an envelope, and you got maybe $200 or $300 in yen in
wow.
there.
Wow.
So I played my favorite thing. So the next night, we go into Sapporo. So the promoter sits next to me, and he says, Harold Mayberry. Now, keep in mind, this is the same promoter the night before was kind of standoffish.
Mm-hmm.
See, the power of the music.
Right.
He said, I have an idea. I said, yes, I'm listening. He said, a group with 10 piano players. I said, yes. He said, we call it 100 gold fingers of jazz, 100 great fingers of jazz. And he sat on it. So most of the people that's on there is 10 piano players. I recommended 7 of them.
Okay.
A lot of them don't know. It's no big thing.
Right.
And I threw out a lot of names, but he couldn't use everybody.
Right.
So then what we would do, we would play. You could play trio. Bob Crenshaw was on it. Alan Dawson, rest his soul. You could play solo. You could play whatever. If you think you can play, now's your chance. So most of the times I played by myself.
Mm.
So one night when we have what they call an encore, where John Lewis would say, tonight we're going to do music from television themes.
Mm.
Next night we're going to do music from movies.
Right.
Next night, bro, oh, yeah, you should have seen guys scratching their heads trying to figure out, I don't know, no TV thing. So
oh, no.
Ray Bryant, in case you don't know much about him, his nephews are Kevin Eubanks and Robin Eubanks. Those are his sister is their mother.
Okay.
So anyway, so he would look at me, Ray Bryant, say, hey, Mae, what you going to play tonight? I said, I'm not telling, because we knew quite a, not bragging, we knew a lot of tunes. See, again, thanks to Bill Lee. In Chicago, you had to learn how to play what we call the Great American Songbook. So this particular night, I played the Candy Band. So Mutch Alexander, he said, hey, Mae, that was really nice what you did, played that song for Sammy Davis Jr. And I just think, well, so this had been in my mind for 20-plus years.
Wow.
And I said, what should I do? And so when I got this date, we never did get a chance to rehearse because everybody was busy. We got back on from Japan May 8th, 2012.
Mm-hmm.
We went in the studios May 10th. No rehearsal because everybody was busy. I got with Eric for a little rundown so he could learn the melodies. So then I thought about it. I said, Sammy Davis Jr., as he again, as Gunnett Brown would say, been slightly misconstrued, unfortunately, by most of his own people, misunderstood, put down. I say, hey, Sammy Davis Jr. is the greatest entertainer ever, bar none. Sorry, Michael Jackson.
No, that's true.
Sorry, Jack, bar none, because I just spoke to Jimmy Orange last week at Crenshaw, and he said Sammy Davis came somewhere and picked up his trumpet and started playing it.
Wow.
And if you want to see how great he is, you can download him on YouTube singing I Gotta Be Me.
Mm-hmm.
It's several verses, but this one's where he's singing Maybe I'm Right. Mm-hmm. And he has his back turned to the audience, and the band is playing, and he's putting on the rings, Maybe I'm Wrong. And then he's singing behind the beat like Joe Williams. And when he did that, I said, wow, you got to know what you're doing. In other words, he was playing catchy with the lyrics.
Right, wow.
So then I said, you know what? Sammy Davis Jr. has more class, or had more class and talent than a lot of these jacklegs put together, you know. And so I said, I'm going to do that. And because he once said, to whom it may concern, I can't hit a home run standing outside the stadium.
Right.
In other words, let me get on playing field, because everything he did, these guys or whatever are reaping the benefits now.
Right, right.
So I decided I wanted to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got to the studio, even the studio people didn't know what I was going to do.
Mm.
Most time they give you a concept sheet saying, maybe you should do this.
Mm.
So I gave them the sheets of the song. So by the third tune, I could see Joe Fields. Even the musicians didn't. I kept it on the rap.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know.
Uh-huh.
And by that third tune, they started smiling.
Oh.
And I think the date turned out to be, it'll go down in history as one of my favorites because of what it means and what it stood for.
Yeah.
Because it's a happy record.
Right.
You know, it's not sad. The tunes are happy. You know, the tunes are different. Like, I went to Sammy's last record they called the Sammy Davis Jr. Story, and he did the song called The People Tree, was written by Anthony Newley and Leslie Brickus, and it was from a Broadway show that never really made it. So long story short, that's how that came about, and I'm glad I did it, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, you had mentioned Michael Jackson. Even right. Michael Jackson admitted
had
that,
to.
You know, Sammy Davis Jr. was...
Had to. Greg LeHand.
Yes.
One of a kind.
Yes.
Very articulate, you know. And, no, I have nothing but tremendous respect for him, you know.
Now, on Mr. Lucky, you have the People Tree, as you
right.
mentioned. As Long As She Needs Me.
Right.
Soft Shoe Training with
That's
Sammy.
One,
that
I
That was
tell
something you had written.
See, I ride the subway a lot, right? See, I tell people, and that's true, music is all around you. Mm-hmm. There are times when you can wait for the subway, and you might hear the train coming, you hear, that's
mm-hmm.
a beat.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always riding the subway train. So I was going, I don't know where I was going. So, you know, and they say, please watch the closing doors, please. And you hear, ding dong.
Uh-huh.
Ding. Next time you take the train, just mm-hmm. get ding dong. So I said, oh, that's how I wrote that song. Ding dong, ding dong.
Thank you.
And I call it Soft Shoe Training with Sammy, T-R-A-I-N-I-N. But the melody is like John Coltrane, T-R-A-N-E. It sounds like some train would play.
Okay.
Because I found a long time ago, when you do a record date, always have one tune on there because you never know when it might be a big hit. So that's why I snuck that on. So if it sells, then I get a taste of it.
Excellent. Now, let's see. What else you have on here is like, Hey There.
Hey There. I did that solo piece. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've Got to Be Me.
Right.
Of course.
Right.
It's like it wouldn't be
right
fair if you didn't.
Exactly.
Mr. Lucky.
Mr. Lucky.
What Kind of Fool Am I?
Right.
Another one.
I did that trio. With the trio, right.
Night Song.
Right. And that's for my Golden Boy.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Something's Gotta Give.
Something's Gotta Give, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm really pleased with that, they, you know.
Yeah. Well, I've heard a couple of the cuts on another radio station.
Right. They still remain nameless.
Yes.
Right. Well, listen, I'm glad you're hearing it on that other station.
Exactly. Down the dial.
Right. Right. Exactly.
Dates to promote Mr. Lucky.
Right.
Do you have some coming up?
So we started Smoke on the 24th of December for 8 straight days. Mm-hmm. I promoted there.
Oh, okay. You know. All right, people, pay attention.
Pay attention.
It's going to be at Smoke.
Yeah, that's right.
Starting the 24th.
24th.
If you want to get your copy, get it there.
Get it there. That's true.
when you see him.
And I tell the folks, the CD is free, but the autograph is $20. So Joe Farnsworth said, well, what about if they don't want it? I said, you can't get one without the other.
You know, we generally don't do prices on the radio.
Right.
But, you know, I'm going to keep that one.
Okay.
So you've been working with Bob Crenshaw for a long time.
Well, here's the thing. His wonderful wife, Bobby, kind of, when I mentioned the other night, she said, now stop that. But always say, Bob likes it. He wants me to say it. When I first met Bob Crenshaw, he was working, I call it the garbage truck, because then they didn't say he hadn't earned the right to be called sanitation man.
Oh, okay.
He was just a garbage man.
Right.
He played football with double zero.
Uh-huh.
He said, that's right. So so when Walter Perkins was getting the groove, he said, yeah, baby sweets, we're going to get this groove. You and Frank George and me and Bobby Crenshaw was going to play bass. I said, you mean that garbage man guy? He said, yeah, because I didn't know he played the bass.
Uh-huh.
So we go way back. You know, we first met in 54, you know.
Yeah, well, you were saying, he turns 80 this year, right?
He
turned 80?
December 10th, he was 80. He turned 80 years old.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he looks like he's
He really does. You know. But see, I'm convinced, and I tell Michael and my daughter Roxanne, you know, they worry about me getting, I say, when I'm on the bandstand, I don't get tired. Mm. I get tired when I take the intermission.
Mm.
Because the music rejuvenates you.
Right.
I really can't. It's a special blessing that the most have. For example, I remember a couple of years ago at a Monday night Thanksgiving party, Candido, I think, is just about 90 years old.
Yes, he's over.
He was walking to the bandstand with a walker. He had two people trying to help him write. He got on the bandstand, sat down on those congas. He played like he was 20 years. Now, explain that.
That's true. It's true.
The music is, hey, that's a double blessing to be able to play this music and be rejuvenated, you know, so to speak. You know.
Right. So is there anything you want to tell the listeners of WBAI that we probably didn't talk about? Because there's so much.
Well, I can't think of too much more except support your music. I'm serious about this because this is your music, people. And when we go to Europe, the Europeans love us, but the Japanese idolize us.
Mm-hmm.
And the Japanese, these are young people, will spend $100 music charge, no food, one set to hear us play.
Right.
So now something is wrong. This music was created here.
Right.
Don't take this for granted. And I always say this. I throw this out. I always like to say that jazz musicians are the smartest people in the world. We're not better. We're different.
Mm-hmm.
Joshua Redman has 2 degrees, one from Harvard, one from MIT. Dr. Willie Ruff, I thought he only spoke the Chinese language for 6 years. The Chinese language was his 7th language.
Wow.
He's up at Yale now. Herbie Hancock's major is electrical engineering.
Mm.
Keith Jarrett did the Goldberg variations on the harpsichord.
Wow.
See, I look at Keith Jarrett as the primetime Glenn Gould.
Mm.
Now, if you know anything about the Goldberg variation, I understand that Bach wrote this for one of his dearest friends who was insomniac, didn't have nothing to do. Bach said, well, I'll write this piece of music so you can stay up all night and give you something to do.
Wow.
Hubert Law is world-renowned flautist. used to go out with Jean-Pierre Rampal, play classical music.
Mm-hmm.
Stanley Cowell, Chopin etudes. You know, Ahmad Jamal was playing Liszt etudes with the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra when he was 10 years old.
Right.
He never talks about it. Phineas Newborn Jr. played all the instruments very well. When he was 12 years old, they said, well, Mr. Newborn, there's nothing else I can teach you.
Wow.
And when he was in Army, a friend told me this story about Phineas. Said they called everybody, and they called Phineas last. Said, Newborn, what instrument do you want? And Phineas said, what instrument do you have? What do you need? You see, so I'm proud to be associated with jazz. We're very smart. Kenny Garrett speaks the Japanese language very well. Now he's studying the Korean language, which is totally different.
Right.
You know, Booker Little could have been a classical trumpet player. Lee Morgan could have been a classical trumpet player.
Mm-hmm.
Branford Marsalis plays classical alto.
Mm-hmm.
Natural Winter, you know, so I'm proud to be associated with these group of people, men and women. Bill Russell used to follow Cannonball Adderley around all the time at Birdland because he, again, the Boston Celtics played basketball like jazz musicians played.
Right, right.
The New York Knickerbockers during that time, Dr. Dick Barnett, one of my closest friends, I'm not name dropping, I wrote a song based on his jump shot called Too Late Fall Back Baby. We recorded a few years ago with Keno Duke.
Oh, okay.
You know, so that's the only thing I want to say, main thing, support this music. Because this is your music. It was created in this country.
Well, thank you so much, Harold Mayburn, for coming in to WBAI and spending this time with us. This is just an extreme pleasure.
And if I can, I'd be remiss, as Mike would say, if I don't give a can. I give a shout-out to the family members, because if I don't, they'd say, I'll say a shout-out to Roxanne and Michael Hajduchek, Michael Mayburn, Judith Mayburn, my little wonderful, talented granddaughter, Marius. She plays piano better than me, the Boogie Woogie.
Wow.
And my sister-in-law, Wendy Thomas, and Eric, and George Coleman and Joe Donnett Brown. That's a little shout out.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr.
Thank you again for inviting me.
All right. Is indeed in the background. Too Late, Fall Back Baby. It's from Pisces Calling. Not an easy recording to find, to tell you the truth, but I'm glad I did. I'm digging it. And let's see, before that we heard Soft Shoe Training from Mr. Lucky, a tribute to Sammy Davis Jr. on High Note Records. S, and do not forget, you can get your copy of Mr. Lucky at Smoke on the 24th, tomorrow, Tuesday. No, not Tuesday, Monday. Duh. Yes, this is Sunday night going into Monday morning. Monday, later today, tonight, you can go to Smoke in Harold Mayburn. Mr. Harold Mayburn is starting his run at Smoke. Yeah, I'll get the website and all that other stuff in a second. Let me finish this so we can hear the rest of this song. Before that, we heard The People Tree, also from Mr. Lucky, a tribute to Sammy Davis Jr. And before that, we heard Mr. Stitt from Straight Street. And that actually is a trio recording that includes Ron Carter and Jack DeJohnette with Mr. Harold Mayburn. And let's see. That's it. Before that, we had Betty Carter and... I wonder how, you know, I haven't quite gotten the new phone number, so I couldn't invite people to call, but some people know the number already. But anyway, thank you for listening. We're going to listen to the rest of Too Late, Fall Back Baby, and maybe we can hear a little Greasy Kid stuff, and maybe I'll come back. Stay tuned. Oh, Greasy Kid stuff, by the way, has Michael Mayburn on the cover. a six-year-old, but it was apparently inspired by a six-year-old Michael Mayburn from Creative Unity Collective. Yeah, I'm going to tell all your business, Michael. This is WBAI New York. Sugar my bowl. My name's Joyce Jones. Stay tuned. Okay, I just wanted to let you know that that trumpeter was Lee Morgan on this Greasy Kid Stuff Harold Mayburn recording. Coming up next is La Nueva Alternativa. I can say that with confidence. Seeing one of the brethren right now. I can say that with confidence. Stay tuned. I actually am going to do a little presto change-o right now. In line with the season. Have a great holiday, folks. See you next year. This is Joyce Jones. This is WBAI New York, signing off for Sugar in My Bowl. Stay tuned. Oh, by the way, I neglected to mention that this is the great Vince Guaraldi trio. Stay tuned.
This is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.
Become a BAI buddy and help reduce our on-air fundraising days.
For just 33 cents a day,
$10 a month,
or more if you can afford it, you can become a BAI buddy and help your non-commercial radio station stay on the air.
BAI buddies get discounts at local shops, museums, and live events.
Become voting members of station board elections.
And receive our new WBAI tote bag.
To become a BAI buddy, go to our website, WBAI.org, and click on the link. I'm Dekwi Keone Siddiqui.
And I'm Sally O'Brien. Become a BAI buddy today and keep listening to Where We Live, 8 p.m. Thursday over listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI New York.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much for caring.